You're listening to Longwoods Radio, your healthcare source for ideas, new policies, and best practices. Here's Breakfast with the Chiefs, featuring Murray T. Martin and Cliff Nordell.
Pleasure to be here with you today and back on the West Coast and able to see so many friends in the audience. When Anton talks about that Cliff and I have been around for a while, when we're actually writing the paper and I'm trying to figure out how many combined years, my greatest fear is that it would actually add up to 80, but it's only 70 plus. But one of us is older than the other, and I'll leave that to your judgment as to which way that is. Anyways, what this paper is about is a visit that Cliff and I undertook in the fall of 2006 to Australia and New Zealand. And the impetus for the trip was, in actual fact, I had the good fortune of my board, when they asked me if I would renew my contract for another 5 years, they said, and in addition to that, you can we would like you to consider going and taking a trip for 6 or 8 weeks and just do whatever you want and find something you might find useful. And I thought, gee, they must think I look old and tired. But took advantage of the opportunity and along the way talked Cliff into joining me. And so we actually wanted to go to a country and look into an issue that we felt was really important to the Canadian healthcare system. And that was what happens when you have an environment of private hospitals and public hospitals. And particularly our focus was, what is the impact on public hospitals of having a significant number of private hospital activity.
So that we felt that Australia and New Zealand were in many ways culturally similar to Canada, that they operate comparable systems. So off we went to Australia. Just some of the metrics of the two countries in terms of the large geographic area, obviously, in Australia, similar to Canada. Obviously, major problems with some of it burning up at the moment, but a very large country. A little smaller population, but something similar to Canada. Life expectancies similar, infant mortality rates, population growth, etc. A lot of similarities to our system. In terms of healthcare expenditures, more in the realm of what Canada spends than, say, the U.S. So if you look at relative position, similar expenditures per capita on healthcare. Australia has some similarities at the governance level in terms of, rather than provinces, they have states, and there are seven states and six states and two territories. There is a significant difference, though, in the fact that in Australia, hospitals are state-run, but the federal government funds physicians. And so you can just imagine the alignment issues that in actual fact come out of that, because you'll have negotiations taking place on a national basis with their physician organization. And when you're trying to create alignment between some of the priorities of the hospital system, that presents a major challenge for them. New Zealand, as everyone knows, is I think geographically probably very similar to Vancouver Island, and I think from a population point of view, the parallel would be if you took everybody that lives in British Columbia and put them on Vancouver Island, you could rename it New Zealand, and that is a parallel, and it has mountains as well, so and is a beautiful place. In terms of when we look at the system level, Australia and New Zealand combine universal public funding for medically necessary physician hospital and drug services in a similar way to Canada. But the biggest difference is the next bullets of a parallel system of private finance for inpatient hospital care, and that is really the major difference that we actually looked at. At the very bottom bullet, the split between public and private is about the same as Canada, in terms of about a 70-30 split, 70% public, 30% provincial. But actually, the big difference is in what makes up that split. In Australia, there is actually more public funding of things like drug programs, dental programs, and so that's the offset to what is spent on the private side in hospital care in Australia. So different countries have made different choices as to what the 30% private would in actual fact make up. Hospitals of different type, and this is another small difference, but significant in some ways. Within the categorization of hospitals, religious order hospitals like Catholic hospitals, like St. Paul's here in Vancouver, in their system are private hospitals. So that as well makes a significant difference, and Cliff will talk a little bit more about that. In terms of there is a growing element or growing portion of their hospital system that is private. In actual fact, the fastest growing part of their system is the private hospital system. And these were just one of the things we felt necessary, being we were on a sabbatical. We wanted to prove that we actually did go to some hospitals. So one day we ran around and took a few pictures of some. And there's some other interesting pictures we'll show you that actually will, I think, impress upon you the differences. One of the things that we wanted to do in terms of, we visited a large number of private and a large number of public hospitals, but we wanted to take a methodology approach to it where we were asking consistent questions. So we actually framed 8 specific questions. We sent the questions to everybody ahead of time. To let them think about them before we actually arrived, and then we went through a process of interviews. Usually they went anywhere from an hour to 2 hours. Certainly we were very well received, both in public and private, and we went through all of these questions with them. And it is really on the basis of the responses to these questions that we then wrote our paper. So now over to Cliff.
Thanks, Murray, and good morning. These particular questions formed a framework. Lots of dialogue that we'd have, and of course we would go on tours as well, sometimes self-directed ones, but on many occasions the CEO or one of his or her staff would actually take us around. And in advance of going there, we would had a chance to review the literature and look at papers. It's wonderful to be able to access the web because you can go and see what's happening in the country and actually view minutes of their board meetings, which are public, and you can see what's going on. The newspapers full of healthcare stories. And we had no difficulty finding controversial ones, just like here in Canada, particularly in certain cities like Sydney, where the healthcare system seemed to be a bit under attack there. Controversial issues in the other parts of the media, particularly on radio, talk show hosts would be sort of baiting the public to have them call in to explain to them their healthcare horror story of the week. So it's a little bit of an entertainment piece for them. So this was part of our impressionistic work as well. Is there a difference? You bet there is. This is a sign in the emergency department at a small private hospital in Melbourne, the John Faulkner Hospital. If you go into that emergency department, are you going to pay? Absolutely. Whether you have insurance or not, you're still going to pay. $200, and then your insurance may kick in, depending on the type of coverage that you have. The ER department may choose to be open or closed at its discretion. If it's closed, you can try and find another private hospital where you'd like to go to. You may have a relationship, or you may be part of the chain of hospitals, or you can go to the public system. Even if you have private insurance, you can choose to go to the public system as well. In the reverse, you have to pay everything. You could go, but the cash at the door. There are 37 insurers. They run several funds over and above that. About two-thirds of them are open to anyone joining. One-third are closed members to those unions or professional associations, groups that have founded them, and they tend to be a bit smaller. It's a different insurance system than we would have here in Canada or particularly in the U.S. Everything is community rated. So if you have diabetes versus somebody who's in perfect health, they're going to pay the same premium amounts. There are three major cover areas: in hospital services and the ancillary general treatment outside of a hospital. And then ambulance cover can be thrown in or not. Multiple types of insurance with different types of co-payments, different things covered. So there could be a different co-payment for the different parts of the spectrum of care that you decide to sign up for. And there are gaps. In other words, the insurance plans may not cover all of the physician's fees. And some plans offer gap coverage, which is a little extra premium, or you can pay that yourself. Now, the physician gets to choose whether they're going to participate in gap coverage. If they're part of that plan system and they'll accept that insurance, great. If they do not, then you have to pay over and above that. The surgeon might participate in gap and the anesthetist not, so you have to pay the anesthetist extra. If you have an illness and join a plan, you may have a waiting period of up to a year. This applies to obstetrics. For the most part, it's only a two-month waiting period. Now, the other interesting piece is that the federal government, the Commonwealth, has encouraged insurance, and they do this through rebates, and you can get that right through your insurer just as a reduction in your premium, or you can collect it directly from the federal government. So a very different kind of insurance scheme, and I would think if Canada were ever to move in this kind of area, they ought to look at how the Australians have done insurance versus the Americans, because there's a lot more equity in it, and the cost of the premiums are really quite reasonable. You know, $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 for fairly extensive coverage. Still, we found the system pretty fragmented. There are multiple providers, public and private, of course. They can be located adjacent to one another. Catholic hospitals, as Murray mentioned, operate in the public sector, taking care of public patients as well, but they will have often a private hospital adjacent to them, sometimes actually right within the same building. Now, any public hospital can also have private patients, and that enables the person coming into the hospital to choose their physician. And that's the big difference. You can choose your doctor and have that individual take care of you. The hospitals in the public system are jammed. They're very, very busy, and they have some of the same problems that we do in getting the access and flow issues dealt with properly. Well, there's competition, of course, out there for services. There's about 60% of the nursing staff are full-time. The agency business is healthy there, particularly as private hospitals use staffing to balance their cost structure as well. They're very aggressive about that, and that, of course, optimizes their return as well. Surgeons' income are dependent on the successes in the private system a lot, and you will see productivity is substantially higher for them. In other words, they do more procedures more quickly in the private system. We found that of the CEOs that we interviewed, except I think for one person, had all had background experience in the public system beforehand. It's relatively stable. People have been there for, you know, 10, 15 years or longer, whereas in the public system, except for a handful, there's substantial turnover. And I think those that wear a long service CEOs have in fact moved on since we were there. And some of them are actually quite inexperienced in the sense that they have never been a CEO before and we're only in the role for just a few months before we have a chance to visit with them. Now this is an interesting shot. This is in Sydney. At the left of your screen is the Royal North Shore Hospital, which is the big tertiary hospital in the North End, the workhorse of that part of the city. And across this laneway, connected by a bridge, is the North Shore Private Hospital. One's close to 600 beds. The private is about 190 beds. It's when it started, and by the way, there's no choice on the part of the public where this private facility was going to be located. The government decided that. When it recruited its staff, guess where they came from? And I think it's fair to say it's been there 10 years, and the Royal North Shore has not recovered from that experience. They've struggled ever since. The medical staff are common, mostly the surgeons and anesthetists, and some of the support specialty staff that may support the surgeries over there. They use this bridge a lot. And the parking lot is on the other side of the hospital. Stark difference in the environment when you're there. One's kind of, you know, relatively cozy and it's not that busy. And the other place looks a bit shell-shocked. But this public hospital is a hugely important asset to the city. And you may have seen some of the stories. That was absolutely in the press while we were there. Compensation for nurses, not really a major factor. They both use the same wage scales that are negotiated centrally by the major unions. And I think that's a great strategy for them, in fact. I think it keeps their costs in check. They'll provide some additional perks, time off, easier weekends, little weekend stuff, and it is, of course, much more predictable work. If you're the CEO of that private hospital, your salary for a facility that's less than half the size is at least double. And you're highly operationally focused, you don't have to worry about the government calling you, and the reporting requirements are relatively modest compared to the CEOs across the laneway. Doctors, of course, earn a substantial income from the private system, and I think one would say that they do generally quite well overall. So why do people choose one versus the other? These were some of the reasons. Of course, there are certain aspects of care that are only in public. Major trauma, children's hospitals. If you want to be in mental health, these kinds of things are all in the public system. Complexity, intensity. If you get your charge from being in a real busy ER department, work in the public system. Research, primarily in the public system. But in the private, compensation is a bit better for the doctors, for sure. And for staff, you know, the physicians are very generous towards them. Particularly at Christmas and the social functions and stuff like that. And the workload generally is far less stressful and more predictable. Of course, people work in both of the systems, so they know it. Surgeons' work is at a different pace in one versus the other. And many cases, the part-time staff in the private are coming from the public system. Of course, for them, it's sometimes a short walk to that second job. Training is primarily in the public system, although that, frankly, has become an issue, as noted here. If you think of all or large parts of the elective surgical work moving from the left side over to the right side of that laneway, training opportunities really do move or need to move as well, and we're starting to see shifts occurring where the government itself has recognized that in order to maintain good training programs covering a comprehensive part of the work, that it does need to shift into the private system. But there is an interesting factor. If you're a patient in private, you really want the physician, surgeon that you're expecting to care for you, do that procedure, to do the work, not a trainee. So it does create some interesting dynamics there. Well, I'm going to turn this back to Murray, but just so that you don't think we just were on this visit, we kept in touch. We found some novel places to do that, street benches. And here is Murray working hard in, I think this is actually the cafeteria in the Royal North Shore Hospital, doing a little email from work.
Thanks, Cliff. I was answering emails, and Cliff was checking on the stock market. This actually was something I found interesting is in the cafeteria. I think it was at the North Shore Hospital of these terminals all along one wall, and they were obviously very used by staff. One of the interesting things is the picture that Cliff showed of the bridge. We actually went first to the private hospital in the morning, and then went over to the public, and we went across the bridge. And the CEO of the private explained to us that we could go over there, but to come back, you actually need a pass. A pass card to come back into the private, and just talking to the CEO of the public hospital, that was actually the public hospital's land that the private hospital was built on, and the thing that just annoyed them the most, as Cliff said, is they actually put this building then in between their parking lot, and so the staff had to walk all the way around it. So it was in terms of creating dynamics that weren't friendly. An interesting setup. Just saw a couple of the other quibs about those two hospitals. They actually had two cardiac surgery programs. So in the public hospital, they did about 600 open cardiac surgical procedures. In the private, they did, I think, about 400. So significant programs in both. But one was the private patients, and there was the need for a lot less backup in the public or in the private, and the reason for that is that if anybody got really sick, they just took them across the bridge to the public, so that the private hospital would explain to the government how they could do the procedure so much cheaper than the public, that was because all of their backup infrastructure, for as we all know, expensive patients are the ones that really get sick, so a great reason for having them next door. Is in a private system, you the last thing you want is anybody that's actually really sick. So that's not how you make money. It has to be predictable outcomes. So you know you make money having them there for 4 days. And if you got one that's going to be sick and they're going to be there for 10 days, well, then you have to just chuck, set them across the system. And the public system looks after them. So the relationships, obviously, between the two side by side were not great. Okay, in terms of what role do private hospitals play, we tried to get to issues about quality and about system planning, et cetera, and certainly in Canada with health regions and Ontario and Quebec's versions of that, there's much more of a focus on system planning. And clearly to do system planning, you have to know what each component of the system is delivering. And that is absolutely not the case. The private hospitals are totally outside the system. They do not provide any of their data to government. They do not participate in any planning forums. I can recall one private hospital. It actually was a religious order hospital in Melbourne. And we said, well, have you ever been to a regional meeting in Melbourne about the services? And they said, no. And they said, well, would you come if you were asked? And they said, absolutely not. They would not go to a meeting if they were asked. So then we would ask government people, well, how do you know when they're doing major programs like cardiac surgery and that, what their volume is? And they said, well, we just try to guess. And so that's the relationship. But in terms of, as this says, that they are really surgical hospitals. 90% of the activity in private hospitals are surgical. And interestingly, it's a pairing of an anesthetist and a surgeon, and you can, depending on who you're talking to, you can say who's the junior and who's the senior partner, but they actually work very closely together, And so they're not in surgical groups. It's all one-off individuals. So that if you have 10 general surgeons working in a private hospital, each one of them has their very own practice and look after their own patients. The anesthetists seem in the care model to almost be like anesthetist / general internal medicine specialist, because they actually provide a lot of the post-operative care. So the surgeon is there to do the surgery, and if there's a problem post-surgical, it's really the anesthetist that follows up, and unless the patient needs to return to the OR, the surgeon would not be involved again. In terms of how they allocate OR time, in the early years of the private hospitals, it was based on whoever they could attract to come to the hospital. So if you get an ENT surgeon to come, you're in the ENT business. They're more sophisticated now, though, as they look at profit margins by discipline. So if, as an example, there was a higher markup on urology, they would do more urology. If ENT had a low markup, they can do that stuff in the public hospital. So it was very much about how do you maximize your business model in terms of what you could get. There are certain parts of the system, though, that are not privatized. And I was telling some of the colleagues that I knew from Vancouver General, they have a very good trauma system, and trauma care is not in the private system. Obviously, trauma patients have this bad habit of being quite sick and unpredictable, so that's not a population they would want. So that's totally in the private system, and so they have a very good trauma system. On the other hand, one of the most fragmented parts of their system is their cancer system. You could imagine all of the work and energy in North America that's put into creating integrated cancer systems. There you'll actually have standalone private radiotherapy operations. And so, again, very, very fragmented. Actually, the individual that runs our cancer program in where I am in Hamilton has actually been asked to come out and consult in Sydney to look at their cancer system, because they recognize that they've got major problems with it. Why aren't private hospitals included? As I said earlier, they just do not see themselves to their advantage to participate, because that is not consistent with their business model. Issues of quality, both public and private, fall under the same legislation, so the same regulations apply to private, so that they have to adhere to those. There is an equivalent of Accreditation Canada called the Australian Council. We didn't have the time to get into this in any detail to see whether it's has any similarities to ours. But they supposedly use the same criteria in the public and the private system. But particularly the very small private hospitals, they were quite frank with us. They just did not have the infrastructure to do the data collection, et cetera, that you would see in the public system. But one of the positives is, though, because of the fact that they select patients, they have things like a much lower risk of MRSA or VRE, because first of all, they're just surgical patients. They do a major workup on them before they come into hospital, so they're able to basically block hospital acquired infections at the door by not having them in. So they would never accept the transfer from a nursing home or something like that, where you would have a risk of disease being transferred with it. So as one slide ahead of myself, stringent pre-admission screening. Very few private hospitals provide emergency services. There were some. The religious order hospitals, we were in Melbourne, and there's actually a large sister's hospital there, about a 500